This is the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk TNT.
Good morning and welcome to the best breakfast show on earth, bar none. Hey, you know the saying, right? Build it and they will come. And that is exactly what we are doing here at the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk. How are you all today on this wonderful, fine Wednesday? Wherever you are watching us, be that YouTube, Rumble, Instagram, X, or right here on TNT, do not adjust your set, as they used to say when I was a kid. And you can also take us with you on the app, wherever you're going, dog walking, kids to school, you name it. We can go with you. So let us tell you about what is coming up on today's show. Well, we'll look at the scale of the Tory revolt last night to do with the smoking ban, and we'll ask what it means for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. We'll also be looking at deep fake sexual images. They're to be made illegal in England and Wales, and we'll ask whether legislation can really rein in the power of tech. And also, 1 week on from the groundbreaking CAS review, we'll ask former Olympic swimmer Sharon Davis if the tide is finally beginning to turn. Well, for poor Julian Assange, it really isn't. We've been closely following the Julian Assange case on today's News Talk. We were broadcasting from outside the High Court in February at his most recent court hearing, where his lawyers sought permission from the court to appeal against extradition to the USA. The senior High Court judges delivered a most confusing ruling that essentially threw the USA a lifeline and invited them to deliver assurances that Julian would be safe should he be extradited. They had until this week to do so. When Julian Assange's father, John Shipton, came on this show, he concluded he was as perplexed by the judgment as everybody else. And he told me quite soberly that we were witnessing a death in slow motion regarding his son. Equally, WikiLeaks editor Kristin Hrafnason, who was also on this show, expressed deep concern at the continued politicization of his colleague's case. Well, now the USA have responded to the court, and in the words of Stella Assange, Julian's wife, the United States has issued a non-assurance in relation to the First Amendment and a standard assurance in relation to the death penalty. It makes no undertaking to withdraw the prosecution's previous assertion that Julian has no First Amendment rights because he is not a US citizen. Instead, the US has limited itself to blatant weasel words, claiming that Julian can seek to raise the First Amendment if extradited. The diplomatic note does nothing to relieve our family's extreme distress about his future, his grim expectation of spending the rest of his life in isolation in a US prison for publishing award-winning journalism. The Biden administration must drop this dangerous prosecution before it's too late. Now, if the British courts take the USA's poor application seriously and extradite Julian Assange, they will almost certainly have blood on their hands. Those are my words, not Stella's, although I know she thinks the same. She said so. The court has refused to address the very credible evidence that the CIA planned to kidnap and assassinate Julian Assange. We should all remember this moment the next time the UK or the USA dare to claim we are a free society while lecturing other countries about their lack of press freedoms. Julian Assange has been denied his freedom for 15 years. The entire process has been his punishment. His monstrous treatment has sent out a chilling message to journalism in general. Publish war crimes and we will bang you up. At this stage, there is no doubt that Julian Assange is a political prisoner. His health has suffered tremendously. He spent more time locked up than many people who commit deeply serious crimes. Telling the truth about war criminals should not be a crime. We have sought to criminalize the truth teller, but not the criminals who carry out the act in the first place. We have inverted our entire world, but it's time to bring back some sense to it. Releasing Julian Assange is the only proper and humane thing to do at this stage. I suspect that won't happen, but if he is extradited to the US, then we all should be deeply concerned. An attack on Julian Assange is an attack on every journalist. And on that note, let's find out what's going on with the UK headlines from our Gemma.
Q.
keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And here is Gemma Cooper. Good morning, Gemma.
Morning. I rather wonder what happened to Joe Biden's kind of tacit assurance that they were considering sending him back to Australia after talking with Anthony Albanese. Where's all that gone? You know, was that just a PR spin that we were supposed to take some kind of, oh, you know, common sense and humanity and compassion have prevailed here? That's a very disappointing. But then, of course, the court asked for assurances which can't be given. So therefore, the court legally might say, well, you can't give them. We will grant right to appeal. That's another hearing, though. It will go on and on and on and on. And the stress of court hearings, they're horrible, no matter what, even when you win. They're just so draining. So either way, the effect on the family, the effect on Julian, oh, goodness me, talk about hump day.
It's really awful. It really is awful. But they're continuing the same old thing, aren't they? They're almost kicking the can down the road, the British judiciary. And it's really appalling. They're just wiping their hands of him. And it is awful. Truly, I think Stella is right. I think she said before that they will have blood on their hands. And I completely echo that. I think it's absolutely shocking what's taking place, Gemma. And it is attack on us, isn't it, as journalists?
It is. I mean, it's a very clear message, you know, don't mess with the system or the system will mess with you. You know, I wonder what would have happened actually if Julian Assange had been at the forefront of the freedom movement. Forget the previous stuff completely. You know, if he'd done this type of journalism right at the start of 2020 and exposed everything with the might of people who were wakening up, having their spiritual shift and realizing, you know, the system is not there for us. The system is there for the system. If he was doing that type of stellar work at that point, March 2020 onwards, what would the outcome have been? Because every, you know, you would have had half the world behind him by now, more than half the world by now. But of course, it occurred before when people weren't aware of what really how war is, how the system is, how the press are controlled. People didn't care. People were going around their lives in the matrix, very oblivious, living the small narrow life we're programmed to live. And now people realize. You know, so I just wonder what would have happened if his time in history was just a little bit different and a little bit further on. What would be the outcome now? They probably wouldn't have dared to touch him. He'd probably have his own show, wouldn't he? His own podcast, you know, about all of this. So it's just timing is everything in life, isn't it? And his timing's been particularly bad. Not by design.
No.
Yeah.
No, not by his design. Might be by somebody else's though, eh, Gemma?
Well, exactly. Exactly.
Indeed.
Anyway. One to watch. And I'd be interested to see what Anthony Albanese's got to say about this. He did say at the time, didn't he, of the hearing, we're engaging in very high diplomatic talks all behind closed doors. It's another country's legal process. Well, it's two countries' legal processes, UK and US. You know, only a week ago we were talking about Biden considering it. Maybe it just shows that, you know, Biden has no power whatsoever, which we all know, and nobody takes him seriously, not even his own justice system. So we kind of all know that, but there it is, right in front
they
of everybody.
They reined him in off after that off the cuff comment. They did. They said, you can't be saying stuff like that. Right. You're our puppet. Don't think you've got an independent mind on this kind of stuff. So, yeah, he was reined in. I'm sure of it. I don't think for a second that he misheard. Some people are like, oh, no, he's old and senile. He misheard. No, he knew exactly what that question was. And he responded the way that he felt was appropriate at that moment in time. And somebody said, oh, no, absolutely not. So, yeah, absolutely. So, Gemma, tell us what's going on in the UK today.
Well, some interesting headlines. I mean, one is a story that actually did break yesterday, but it's definitely worthy of further analysis because it's been described as a victory for all educational establishments in the UK. And that's the very controversial story about the Muslim pupil who took her school in London, a very high performing school with an excellent reputation. She took the school to the High Court over its decision to ban Muslim prayers in the playground. This was a story that broke last year. We've covered it extensively on many shows on TNT. And yesterday, the High Court ruled in favour of the school, not the pupil, and said that the school's decision to ban prayers was lawful and that the pupil has lost her challenge. She's not going to be appealing against this decision, but it is a very interesting story, which I think we'll come back to. Our unelected foreign secretary, dodgy Dave Cameron, who says he's got no plans to ever return as prime minister. That means he'll be returning as prime minister. He's touched down in Israel this morning for further talks about the country's response to the Iranian drone strikes at the weekend. We'll keep tabs on that throughout the day and see if any nuggets come out of that we can analyze. And, you know, some kind of good news, inflation is down. in the UK, down to 3.2 from 3.4, less than expected, but still a win, say many economists. But it doesn't mean prices are going down. It just means they're rising less fast. So still the squeeze on the UK consumer who, you know, in real terms, we've got less money in our pockets than ever before. But at least there's some good signs on hump day that, you know, the economy at least might be slowing a little bit in terms of high inflation. And of course, mortgage rates, the death pledge, which affects so many people and dominates so many people's lives and ruins so many people's lives in many cases. So maybe they will take that as a little bit of good news for a Wednesday, Sonia.
I'll take anything at this moment in time as a bit of good news, Gemma. But tell us more about what is going on at the Michaela School in Wembley regarding Catherine Birbal Singh and that Muslim prayer ban.
Well, I mean, it's a story that's rumbled on and on. I think what is significant here is the fact it ever got to court at all. And also the fact that the pupil and the lawyers were given £150,000 of legal aid, taxpayers' money, to bring this case. Now, just a little bit of background. I'm sure if you're in the chat, you might, or listening, you will know a little bit about this because it has generated so many headlines. But Michaela School in Northwest London, very high achieving school. Catherine Birbal Singh, head teacher that's been praised for her approach, very strict approach to how the kids are taught there. And it's a secular school. Religion never has come in to the teaching programme. Last March, a few Muslim pupils, who make up about half of the school, 700 pupils there, Muslim pupils are about half, 30 or so of them started praying in the playground using their blazers as prayer mats. And the school said, no, we're not that type of school. There is, you can pray at home, you know, but school is not the place. And they banned it. One pupil, and it is just one pupil, said this was discrimination. The school was subject to a target of hate on social media. There were bomb threats, all kinds of things that the school came under for this ban. And the one pupil, with the backing of her mother, took this to the High Court and got £150,000 of taxpayers' money, legal aid, to do it. Now, legal aid in the UK is normally there for people in criminal cases who can't afford a lawyer, and there has to be a threshold of seriousness with the case that you get money from the Ministry of Justice through the legal aid agency to help you afford to pay for your case, for your prosecution. It does apply sometimes to civil cases, but again, there's a threshold of seriousness, and you must see the benefit of bringing this case for the individual, their family, or the environment in which they're in. Clearly, somebody thought there was a chance of this pupil winning, and she got her team got £150,000. That is really under scrutiny, that decision today. And many people questioning if this was a different faith, if this was a Christian pupil taking her school to court, would the lawyers have said, look, you've got no chance of winning this one. It's a secular school. Prayers are for outside of school. You're not going to win it. Let's not bother. In this case, somebody clearly thought, we've got a chance here. And is it because of tensions running high? Is it because it's got echoes of Rochdale? Nobody wants to go against somebody of the Muslim faith for fear of being called racist or Islamophobic. Those are questions that are being thrown open. The head teacher herself has said this is a victory for all schools. And she did say, this is what our school is about. And if you don't like it, don't come here. It is as simple as that. And I have to say, it's got the most excellent educational achievement record.
It does indeed. We're going to be discussing this further with Jim Ferguson. And we also have a question of the day. And what place is there in schools for religion? You can call us here. Here are the numbers.
Thanks for listening to us. Now we want to listen to you. Our lines are open from the U.S. and Canada. Call 1-888-201-6425. From the U.K., call 033-0024-1026. And from Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310. Free speech is alive and well on today's News Talk, TNT Radio. TNT's Pella Nuroth-Taylor.
All this about the far right. I mean, don't forget, what is now called far right was normal in Europe until the sort of big explosion or the big change in the European elite's view towards migration until about 97 or 2000. It was normal to have a zero net migration. I mean, that was not far right. It was moderate. And then the borders have shifted, the goalposts have shifted for the politicians, but not for the voting public. So I wouldn't call it a far right position to
That's
hold.
Right. It was supposed to be, Europe was supposed to be, I remember it being likened to an egg, in other words, a hard shell on the outside, but completely fluid on the inside. That was the dream of the common European home.
Pella Nuroff-Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands, heal our waters, and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. But every day we lose more of the places we love, and we urgently need to save endangered lands, waters, and wild species. The actions we take today will determine the tomorrow we leave to our children and grandchildren. The water they drink, the air they breathe, the beauty they experience. To learn more about how you can help protect and conserve our beautiful world, visit nature.org today.
Without CO2, the world stops breathing. CO2 sustains all life on Earth. Government, the WEF, and the elite believe humans are the carbon they really want to be rid of. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And we are back, and our question of the day is, what place is there in schools for religion? And I believe that we have Siv on the line to answer that question. Good morning, Siv.
Well, hello, Sonia, and I'm the same Siv behind the emails that I've been sending you, so I hope this is a first for you. Look, I think there is a place for religious schools in the sense that parents should be allowed to choose that for their children if that's what they believe that they should have. I'm all about the freedom thing, and I think freedom is being able to have some kind of choice, and to almost say, well, you know, religious schools, there's no place for religion. There's no, I mean, that's where all our moral codes actually come from, some form of religion. You don't have to believe the religion, but that's where we learn that you don't steal from somebody else. That's where we learn all these different things. So if a parent chooses to take their child to a school like that, then I think there is a place for it.
Thank you, Siv. I absolutely appreciate that. Thanks for calling in. You are literally our first caller on the Sonia Poulton Show, so thank you.
Well,
much appreciated.
I need to frame that as a trophy. I need to actually go and get a little
you do, Siv.
Frame it and stick it up on my wall. Good to talk to you, Sonia.
You too. Take good care of yourself. Thank you so much for calling us. Thank you. Excellent. So that's Siv's take on it, that, yeah, there should be a place in schools for religion if people so desire, because he believes in the freedom of it. Right. Let us go to our next guest. Now, Rishi Sunak's flagship smoking bill was passed in the Commons last night, despite a Tory revolt that saw nearly 60 MPs vote against it. Many of those rebels were right-wing contenders for the Tory crown, who will be jostling for position to become leader. So what does this vote tell us about where the Conservative Party stands on civil liberties? And has the scale of Tory revolt weakened Rishi Sunak further? So joining us with his thoughts is Head of Campaigns for Popular Conservatism, Andrew Allison. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning to you.
Thank you for being here with us this morning. So this is interesting, quite an interesting revolt taking place or splashed all over the newspapers. Is this really the sort of policy that a Conservative government should be passing, Andrew?
Well, the short answer to that question is no, it shouldn't be. But Rishi Sunak seems to have made this his flagship policy. He mentioned this quite a bit in his leader speech at last year's Conservative Party conference, and I knew there would be trouble then when he announced it. And as you say, almost 60 Conservative MPs rebelled last night. Over 100 Conservative MPs didn't bother voting. Now, of course, some of them might be away, they might be abroad on business, but the vast majority of them just decided that they weren't going to vote at all. And that included Penny Mordaunt, the leader of the House of Commons. So he's in trouble in the sense that he's getting his flagship policy through on the back of opposition votes.
It is interesting, isn't it? Were you surprised at some of the figures that voted against, such as Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick? I mean, what does this tell us about Sunak's position?
Well, I was surprised by one or two people who I didn't think would vote against it, but the people who did vote against it, I wasn't surprised about. I thought that Kemi would vote against it, and I thought that Robert Jenrick and others would vote against it. But I mean, it's hardly surprising because this isn't just this graduated smoking ban. It's also a ban on disposable vaping, and you know, I gave up cigarette smoking through vaping. And I've run a campaign in the past promoting vaping. So that's annoyed me about this. And I think they're also trying to restrict the flavors that are in e-liquid as well. So it's all the headlines are about this graduated smoking ban, which will mean, in 20 years' time, someone who's 35 will be able to smoke and someone who's 34 will not be able to smoke. It's as ridiculous as that. But there's also a lot more to it as well. And I think it's a very unworkable legislation. I mean, the black market is going to cigarettes. The use of them is going to rise. It's just an unworkable bill, I'm afraid. And I think it'll crash and burn eventually.
Well, of course, Liz Truss, former PM, she is a leading opponent of this. She described it as a virtue-signalling piece of legislation. She urged Tories to reject it. She said that there were enough finger-wagging, nannying control freaks on Labour's benches. I mean, this is really what we're talking about here. This is, again, about another attack on our freedoms. Whether people like smoking or not, it is something that people should be at liberty to do if they wish, right?
Correct. And that's the thing. You can't treat adults as if they were children, and especially as this legislation goes further on. I mean, people are living longer these days. I mean, perhaps you will get a 100-year-old being able to smoke a cigar, but his 99-year-old friend will not be able to because it'll be breaking the law. I mean, that's about as ridiculous as this legislation gets.
I wanted to ask you something which is not about the smoking ban at all, but it is current news and it's just come up really. And that was, I wonder if I could get your thoughts on the fact that a Belgian mayor yesterday tried to shut down a national Conservative meeting where Nigel Farage, Suella Braverman were in attendance. What do you think about that?
Well, The mayor of Brussels seems to think he's got a lot of control. Now, it just so happens that I bumped into a GB News presenter at Westminster Tube Station last night, and he mentioned to me that a Belgian MEP had been interviewed by him, and apparently the mayor of Brussels has form on this. He's very good at banning things and getting the police to be involved, but generally it's under the radar. Most people don't know about this. Well, I'm pleased now that everybody knows about this. And even the Belgian Prime Minister has come out and said that this is probably unconstitutional. So it's obviously completely wrong. I mean, it's what they did in communist times, isn't it? It's what they did in fascist days in Europe. So obviously it's completely wrong. It's completely anti-libertarian. It's anti-freedom. But in some ways, I'm rather pleased that this has happened because it's brought these policies out in the open.
I mean, that's the interesting thing, isn't it? Is that what happens is this whole Streisand effect oftentimes, and that is the more they try to silence people or ban what somebody stands for, the more they amplify the message. And that it's very interesting because both the smoking ban and what took place yesterday, it is an attack on our freedoms, isn't it? You don't have to agree with Farage or Suella Braverman to know that they still have a right to say to their freedom of speech, right?
Correct. And you may agree with the smoking ban, but at the same time, there'll be something that you enjoy and they'll try to ban that at some point. And unless you stand with us now against these anti-libertarian measures, then there's going to be no one left to defend you.
I think that's the thing, Andrew, is people always assume it's not going to impact me. Oh, I hate smoking. It's nasty. It's filthy. Like you, I also used to have a smoking habit and it's awful. It's so hard to give up. People have no idea unless they've smoked how difficult it is and how strong the pull. But it is so easy, isn't it, from people from afar to say, oh, that doesn't impact me. I hate filthy smoking. But sooner or later, it's going to roll round to them, isn't it?
Well, these people need to be honest. If they want to ban smoking full stop, then tell us that that's exactly what you want to do. Otherwise, you've just got to let adults be adults and let them make their decisions. And of course, we all make poor decisions. God knows how many poor decisions I've made over the years. I'm sure you have as well. We all do it, but that's part of freedom. And hopefully we learn from our poor decisions.
One final thing, Andrew. Has this all weakened Rishi Sunak? And if so, who do you reckon will be the next leader?
Oh, I can't possibly say. I was discussing this with a number of Conservative MPs last night. You know, no one can really decide on who the leader is. The leader of the Conservative Party and the Prime Minister is Rishi Sunak. Has this weakened him? He probably has a little bit. But we've got the local and mayoral elections and police and crime commissioner elections coming up on the 2nd of May, which is just 2 weeks tomorrow. If anything's going to weaken him, I guess it's going to be that. But I would still put a bet on Rishi Sunak leading the Conservative Party into the next general election.
Oh, I'm going to hold you to that, Andrew. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on today's News Talk. Everybody, it's Andrew Allison, Head of Campaigns for Popular Conservatism, and we'll be right back.
Here's a little news flash.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Australia's unveiled a new national defence strategy with a greater focus on the Pacific as tensions rise with China. Israel's brutality against Palestinians in Gaza is once again in the spotlight after a new mass grave was uncovered at the Al-Shifa hospital. And the BBC has come under fire after one of its radio hosts flipped the script and took aim at the West for refusing to hold Israel accountable for the mounting civilian death toll.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And welcome back. Lindsay on YouTube says, Siv is back live. Welcome back. Siv is a bit of a legend around here. Talking sense as usual too. We should have choice. Send kids to a faith school if that's what you want and not to a secular school. It's not rocket science. And Armin says, keep religion out of schools. And so there you go. Those are two polarizing opinions. But hey, that's what we're all about. We like to hear all opinions around here. Now, smoking isn't the only thing that's set to be banned. The government also announced yesterday that the creation of deep fake images of a sexually explicit nature are to be made a criminal offence in England and Wales. Under the legislation, anyone making explicit images of an adult without their consent designed to cause harm and humiliate will face a criminal record and an unlimited fine. But a defence could easily be that the image was designed for personal amusement and never designed to get out. Is this another example of legislation trying to rein in the slippery beast that is tech? Well, joining us with his thoughts is Rohit Taylor, futurist and CEO of Fast Future. Good morning, Rohit.
Good morning.
So where are we with this? What are your thoughts on this policy? How will it be enforced?
Well, the policy is a great idea. If you go online, if you'd gone online last week and you typed in how to harm my dog, you would have been sent mainly to sites telling you not to do it. If you'd gone in online and said how to make a deep fake porn image or how to make a deep fake porn video, you would have been shown literally hundreds of sites that would show you how to do it. So we know it's very easy to do. And it's really important to have this legislation because it can destroy people's lives if they do have these deepfakes made. And so if you are creating it for your personal choice, then why would you put it online? There's no defense for creating something like this and putting it on the web, literally no defense. And so it's essential that we do it. And government has to be applauded for moving so quickly, relatively speaking, given how long it's taken to put legislation in place around issues with social media. As you say, the challenge is how do we enforce this? I think it's going to take AI, in a sense, to monitor these AI video makers and to see whether we can, on a consistent basis, track these things, spot these things, identify who's created them, and then bring them to justice. And that's the challenge. It's a tech challenge, really, of finding them, and then it's a justice system challenge of making sure that they get the appropriate sort of punishment.
It's a massive challenge. So is it the case, really, that the law has simply been too slow to catch up with the digital world?
It has been generally. As I said, a lot of the stuff on the internet, on social media, it's really taken a long time to catch up with. AI is moving so fast that it's very hard to catch up with the things that are being done because the technology is evolving so quickly. And it inevitably evolves much faster than government can spot that there's an issue and then create appropriate legislation. So I would say, in terms of government machines, this isn't a bad response, and it's actually a lot faster than the most things have happened in the tech domain.
Are there other areas that you think government need to catch up with regarding the internet? Because we do seem to be slow in some regards and yet rather forthright in others. But what is your position on that?
Absolutely. I think we've got to find ways of dealing with slander, with other forms of hate speech. We've got to find ways of dealing with that because it's becoming so prominent. And it's not just deepfake porn videos. We've got over 60 elections happening around the world this year. And in all of them, we're already starting to see deepfake videos. And the problem is, how do we know it's a deepfake most of the time? How do we know it's not an official video because it's been put together? It looks very professional and it turns out it's not. But we have to find ways of doing this because we're starting to shape opinions, we're starting to reinforce people's opinions, and we're starting to influence people at the margin to vote the other way. So I think that's something that is a bigger and bigger concern. And we have to find ways technologically to consistently spot those things and, again, punish the perpetrators in some way to deter them.
My worry about this is that we're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as it were, and that is in a rush to be able to legislate against these deeply wrong things that are occurring. We're also going to swoop in perfectly innocent people who are creating artistry and regular videos. Do you think there's a danger of that?
Well, the deepfake porn stuff, as I said earlier, there's no legitimate reason to be creating that and putting it online if you're creating an image of someone else that's a live human being. Fine if that's your thing, to create something that's an artificial character. But some of the other stuff where artists are creating materials and they're using multiple images to create that of real people, that's a grey area, isn't it? Because if you haven't given permission for your image to be used in a video artwork or a photographic artwork, then I think I think it isn't appropriate to do that without the individual's permission. So although it's a grey area, I think we have a moral sense of what's right there and that permission is key.
I agree with you. And also, before you leave us this morning, Rohit, just some other stuff that's come up in tech news, and that is we've seen that Tesla are about to lay off 10% of its workforce. Does this mean the dream of the electric car is over?
I don't think the dream is over. I think the take-up hasn't been as fast as people would have hoped. Tesla also, its workforce was working not just on electric cars, but on electric trucks. And they've had a lot of problems with their electric truck, which really hasn't seen the demand they wanted. But generally with electric cars, I think an awful lot of the people who would have bought them have now got them. And the generations coming through don't want cars at all. So we're seeing a drop-off in car demand in younger age groups, and that's impacted them because that group were more likely to go down the electric vehicle route. I think it might be that once the world sort of recovers from this period of economic uncertainty and volatility, and people feel a little bit more comfortable that they have the money to buy a new car or switch cars, then you might see the take up grow again. But there's also a glut of electric vehicles out there now, both new and used, sitting on forecourts waiting to be purchased. So it might be a while before we see that roll through to manufacturers and they can start producing in higher volumes again. And there's just so many makers of electric vehicles now. And Chinese manufacturers in particular are coming to market with a lower priced product that's just as good in terms of its functionality, if not better.
But electric vehicles have suffered something of a fallout, haven't they? There's been quite a backlash against them in recent times. I think even, was it Jeremy Clarkson said, I'd had one for 10 years and I'm giving mine up, more problem than it's worth. I'm paraphrasing him here. But there's been a lot of criticism about them. Do you think that plays a part at all?
I think that might be part of it. I don't know to what extent people are really being influenced by Jeremy Clarkson on this, but I think what's happening is that we're discovering some of the faults that only emerge, or some of the issues that only emerge when a car's been on the road 5 years and when an electric vehicle's been on the road 5 years. So there's inevitably some of that, but that also gets played up because people want to say, sensationalize the stories. There are issues with the batteries. There are issues around charging. We still haven't got a smooth way of charging your battery other than having a big cable from your home to the car or plugging your car into effectively a lamppost. And so that's also an issue. There's all sorts of stupid criminality happens around that. But we will get to the point, I think, not that far away, where you'll just be able to kind of remove the battery from your car in a very simple way and plug it in your home so that you don't have to trail cables around. We'll get better and better at manufacturing these electric vehicles, and they'll become more reliable. But also from an environmental point of view, there isn't an alternative right now. There is a big environmental footprint even to electric vehicles. We know that they're not completely clean all the way through from manufacturing to disposal, but they're better generally than conventional petrol fuel cars, and we'll get better at it. And it's kind of essential that we do move to greener modes of transport.
Well, I'd be really interested, anybody viewing right now, which I know there are many, please let us know your thoughts on electric vehicles. Rohit, thank you so much for joining us this morning, giving us a really decent understanding of what's going on in the world of big tech. Thank you. Rohit Talwal, everybody, futurist and CEO of Fast Future. Take good care of yourself. Thank you for joining us this morning. And a reminder, before we go into the break, we're asking about religion in schools today. And is there a place for religion in schools, or should it be kept out of it completely? We'll be right back.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. But the danger to animals the world over is growing, and the need for your help has never been more urgent. On land, you'll help stop poachers from threatening and killing elephants and big cats for the illegal wildlife trade. In the oceans, you'll help rescue dolphins, whales, and seals from deadly hazards. And you'll help rescue, rehabilitate, and release vulnerable animals when disasters strike. Here at home and around the world, we can't do this work without you. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifall.org.
Hi, I'm Abel.
I often forget to mention that he's an amputee because Abel will try any activity he can.
My arm helps me with basically everything.
He doesn't see what he can't do, he sees what he can do.
Yeah, okay. This is helping.
The War Amps has just given him the ability to do all the activities every kid can do.
When you donate to the War Amps, you help kids like me. Thank you!
Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
And Five Eyes says there are said to be around 40,000 child slaves in Congo who are forced to work in cobalt mines so we can drive electric cars. Not only a human cost, but pollution of the landscape around the mines. And so I did ask for your feedback, and look at that, forthright as ever. Thank you, Five Eyes. We appreciate that. Now, joining us for a roundup of some of the day's biggest stories is political commentator Jim Ferguson. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Sonia. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Delighted as ever to have you with us, Jim. We're going to drill down on two big stories with you today. One is head teacher Catherine Birbal-Singh. She's won the legal right to keep her school a secular space. Our question of the day has been, what place is there in schools for religion? What are your thoughts, Jim? What place is there, if any, in our schools for religion?
Well, I think that there's always the safe bet is to have that secular approach. But as a Christian, I'm always of the opinion, I used to remember back in the day where we went to assembly and we said a prayer, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think, though, that when we try to be all things to all people, that's when we become unstuck. So I think in relation to there are more sort of radical aspects, especially of Islam, which we've got to acknowledge and got to address. Now, I've worked very successfully with many people of the Muslim faith, great people. I have no issue at all with it. And I think they should be entitled to preach or practice their religion as they wish. But there comes a point where it becomes dominating. It comes a point where they're trying effectively to push that particular faith on other people. And I think that's where they need to be pushed back. So I can see both arguments here. And I'm normally very much one or the other. But in this case, I can also see the need for having that firm stance. Now, this particular teacher has a reputation for being very strict. And one of the other things is, I look back at my time in school, and I remember having an English teacher who struck fear into the classroom. She did not put up with any nonsense. I got the best grades in her class because she was extremely strict. And you were frightened not to do your homework. I mean, really, you were. So you did it. And I think that's where we're missing the key here. We're missing the mark in education in so many ways, because once again, teachers are trying to be all things to all people. It doesn't work. And children actually they like leadership. They like discipline. They like people to tell them what they need to do. And of course, there will always be that rebelliousness. But a good teacher will always overcome that without alienating people. So yeah, it's a tough one. But I think that the school was right to do what they did. And the other aspect, of course, to this is the fact that this pupil, the family, got legal aid. I mean, right. There's a big question mark about that, because that, frankly, shouldn't be qualifying for legal aid. And my understanding of the legal aid system is that it's very specific as to what that can be used for. The other thing about legal aid is, to my knowledge, and I'm not a solicitor, that money will have to be paid back. But will it? That's the big question here, Sonia.
Well, it is. And especially over the last 10 years, we've seen that the legal aid system has been absolutely savage. People with brilliant cases, you would think, very worthy cases, have been denied an opportunity to be supported in that way through the courts. I was shocked by this. £150,000 is a huge chunk of money, isn't it? Especially at this moment in time. But I do think it's interesting, Jim, and what you have to say about discipline in schools. I've interviewed Catherine Birbal-Singh. She obviously, it's the Michaela School in Wembley. I've lived in Wembley. It is no laughing matter. She is dealing with children who will be from very difficult backgrounds, extreme poverty. Many children will have come into the country, or their families will have come into the country under very difficult circumstances. So she does have to sort of rule that roost to a certain degree. But some people do believe she is actually known as the strictest teacher in the UK. But some people have a real problem with that. But it's interesting what you say. So do you really think that what we're lacking is a sort of a firm hand guidance and discipline in our schools these days?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We do. As I say, we have teachers that try to be all things to all people. And of course, it's not necessarily all the teachers' fault, because they're often having to go by government policy. Once again, our politicians are setting the scene by saying, you've got to be all things to all people. What do teachers do? Well, they've got to follow the curriculum. That's where we're going wrong. But the ultimate problem is that they're putting people into parliament. We all are when we vote for them, when they are not qualified to be in those positions. And of course, the government then handpicks people, not necessarily because of their experience, but simply because they'll do what they're told, a bit like the whole globalist outset or agenda that's taking place. So, you know, you got likes of Grant Shapps, a used photocopier salesman in charge of defence. What does he know about tanks, bombs and bullets? I mean, at one time, they would put people who had been in the military in to those positions. Or they would choose somebody that had been in the education sector or somebody that had been in the health sector to look after the health. And that gave them a huge advantage. And it was also a boost to their credibility. But that's not what happens these days. You get people that are completely out of their depth going into these positions, even prime ministers.
And we also, of course, you've just prompted me to think, of course, Jim, we have a completely unfair system in terms of sort of hierarchical jobs, because they're almost entirely dominated by people who've been put through a sort of private education system, boarding schools, etc. So it almost no wonder Catherine Birbal-Singh is having to work probably overtime with her pupils, because they haven't started life with those sort of advantages. I mean, as an aside, Jim, how do you think we can overcome that in terms of like public office? Because they recently revealed that there is a complete imbalance in terms of public offices, journalism, etc., with people from the private school sector. Is there any way around balancing that up so that there is more of a representative demographic in office?
Well, having a representative demographic in office is an important point. But I mean, I go back to the old adage of people should get the jobs on merit, not on gender, not on sexual orientation, not on colour, not on race or religion. They should get it on merit. I don't care whether somebody's black, yellow, whatever colour they are. If they're good at the job they're supposed to be doing, they should get that position. It's not about giving people shortcuts. In fact, it's a disrespectful way to actually pick somebody for a position just because they're black or just because they're of a different sort of gender or ideology. People should get the job and the position on merit. Are they good at the job? Can they do the job? That is where we're failing. And that goes right to the heart of the education system and the failings in this country, but it also applies to every other sector within the United Kingdom at the moment. We are so woke and we're so politically correct that we are actually destroying ourselves. Yeah.
We really are. Honestly, it's like we're eating ourselves at the moment, isn't it? It's absolutely obscene, which is why it's so good to have a political commentator like you, who's really not afraid to kind of look at the big picture. And I really appreciate the fact that you don't have any clear answer, for example, to the issue of religion in schools. And I think that's good. I actually think more people need to say, I don't know. I think the problem about this world is everybody's so damn sure about what they think and so determined to carry it out that they're not prepared to listen to the other side. So I really respect that, Jim. Now, talking about Parliament, Liz Truss, probably the shortest lived Prime Minister in living history. I think it was about 49 days. It was absolutely ridiculous. She, of course, has her memoirs out, 10 years to save the West. In it, she reveals, of course, amongst other things, there were fleas number 10 in Boris's dog Dylan, an Ocado delivery went missing, the fridge was full of Dominic Raab's protein shakes. And it sort of reads like a comedy, Jim. Anything that you've picked up that you can share with us?
Well, I mean, I haven't read her book, to be honest with you, Sonia, and I probably won't. I don't find her a particularly interesting person. I think she's probably a very nice lady, but completely out of her depth. She was completely out of her depth as Foreign Secretary. I remember when she went to have a meeting with Sergei Lavrov, who is the Foreign Secretary in Russia, and she made a complete diplomatic blunder where she insisted that Rostov-on-Don, which is Russian territory, should be handed back to Ukraine. It was never Ukrainian territory. It caused huge embarrassment within the Foreign Office. And it clearly demonstrated she was completely unprepared for that meeting. But the other thing that struck me about Liz Truss was she was an ardent selfie taker. Now, I've got no problem with somebody that wants to take a selfie, but she did it prolifically. She was all about self-promotion. She is, of course, a World Economic Forum disciple, which in my book rules her out and makes her completely unfit for any kind of public office. Indeed, I would go on to say that anybody who's a member of the World Economic Forum is unfit for public office, not just within the political realms, but within every other realm as well. They should be automatically barred from holding any kind of office that handles public money, for example. The other thing about her, though, is, and I didn't disagree necessarily with her, the things that led on to her demise. I mean, she wanted to reduce tax. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But it goes to show how when she broke rank with the globalist order, they very quickly wrapped her on the knuckles, got her out of there and put their own man, Rishi Sunak, in place. I think it was the Sun that likened her to a lettuce. You know, who's going to last longer, the lettuce or Liz Truss? And the lettuce won. And, you know, the tabloids can be quite ruthless, but they're often on point and they smell blood in the water like circling sharks. They're a bit like bookies. They know exactly when, you know, what the mood of the country is.
And we're all
wise to pay attention to it.
Yeah, I think it was the Star, actually, Jim, because I think she's commented on it. But it's interesting what you're talking about, because obviously central to a very short term was the issue of the mini budget, right? And one of the things that she says in her book, that after she gave the press conference about the mini budget, it was like officiating at my own funeral, she said. And so she's sort of, the writing was on the wall for her then, right?
It was, but on a more serious note, she was unfit for office because one of the other things is we remember the Nord Stream pipeline being destroyed, blown up. I think it was by the United States, and I think the West were highly complicit in it. I've interviewed people, investigators, who have done some remarkable work in looking at that. But one thing that became apparent was her unsuitability for handling sensitive information. For example, She sent a message to the White House, or to Biden, I think it was at the time, saying job done, or words to that effect, literally 30 seconds after the explosion took place. And she did that on an unsecured device. So it goes to show the level of incompetence, really, that's at the heart of the British government. I mean, I'm not surprised to read or to hear about, you know, Dominic Raab's protein shakes and all this other kind of nonsense.
No.
It's a sort of poppycock. I mean, you'd expect her to write about more important things. Yeah.
And it feels like that. It feels very light, actually, in terms of sort of political memoirs in some respect. One of the things that she talked about, of course, was when she went to meet the Queen, when she was entered into Parliament. That was Liz Truss, not the Queen, obviously. And it was 2 days before the Queen was officially reported to have died. And Liz Truss said, "Why me? Why now?" after the Queen's death. I find that a curious thing to say, really, don't you? It feels very inward looking, doesn't it? Somebody else has just died and it's suddenly, "Why me? Why now?" Does that play into the whole hands of the selfie obsession, do you think, Jim? There's a degree of that about Liz Truss.
Absolutely. I've no issue with her Majesty the Queen Elizabeth. She was to all purposes a very, very good person, and I had the privilege of meeting her once at a garden party. But the thing is, I'm not a royalist, but I've nothing necessarily against them. But maybe she bored her to death. I mean, at the end of the day, Liz Truss is not the most exciting. She's not the most exciting person to be around. She's a lightweight, and she's all about herself. So there you go.
We need a little light relief sometimes amongst the news, don't we? There is something she did, though, that I think she'll get your fulsome approval, and that is she tried to cancel COP26, the climate conference in Glasgow in 2021. She said she strongly questioned whether the Jamboree should be a priority for government, pointing to the 200 million plus price tag. I would imagine you support her in that, Jim.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the whole climate scam is exactly that. It's a scam. I mean, even the former founder of Greenpeace has come out and said, this is lunacy, what's going on here. But the whole, you know, the whole natural sort of order has been hijacked by the globalists and used very much for their own agenda. I mean, who doesn't want to save the planet? Who doesn't want to stop pollution going into our rivers and our seas? These are good things. I was never a member of Greenpeace, but I could understand where they were coming from. Although back in the day, they were considered a little bit extreme with some of the things they did. But even he is saying what we're seeing now, being spouted about global warming and global boiling and all these other nonsense. I mean, really, at the end of the day, it is. So, yeah, I would agree with her on that point.
And you're right, of course. I do think we should discount from high office anybody who is involved, for example, with the WEF. Absolutely. And so obviously we're in election year, probably one of the biggest election years worldwide for a very long time. Quite unprecedented in many respects. Any thoughts about the UK election? Does Keir Starmer stand a cat in hell's chance?
He does, if people are stupid enough to vote for him. They have to understand, and I've been doing a lot of work over the last sort of 15, 16 months now, where I've been talking to people in Canada, Ireland, the United States, Australia, New Zealand. They are all infiltrated by globalist parasites like Rishi Sunak, like Keir Starmer. They're all part of the same globalist New World Order, and whoever goes in there are going to enact Klaus Schwab's policies. So you don't have a choice. It's a real dilemma. I mean, who do you vote for? Well, I mean, there are great people in the Reform Party. Richard Tice is not one of them. He's unfit, one, in my opinion, to hold office. But at the same time, there are good people there. So perhaps there's other, the Heritage Party, the ADF. There are other good alternatives out there. And maybe even just going for independence. But yeah, we've got a real problem. The globalists have infiltrated both of the two main parties within the UK, both Conservatives, who are no longer Conservative, and Keir Starmer's Labour Party, which are no longer really Labour either. They're both completely overtaken by the globalists.
I sometimes wonder what world I've woken up in, Jim. Do you do that? Do you just say, oh, God, we're another day of having to deal with these people who have no clue about what is going on the ground? And presumably that's why you do what you do, right?
Yeah, well, I didn't really set out to do any of this. I've been in business a long time and been politically active for a long time. And got back on just because I was so disgusted at what I was seeing with the lockdowns and what was clearly a globalist agenda to take control. You know, central bank digital currencies, digital ID, all of these types of things are all about subverting control. of people. So yeah, exactly. We had to get back in. We had to get stuck in.
Absolutely, Jim. Thank you so much for joining us again. Of course, everybody, Jim Ferguson, political commentator and accidental influencer, I remember him saying last time. Jim, have a fantastic Wednesday. Thank you so much for joining us on today's News Talk. And we will be right back after the break. Do not go anywhere.